Now on BBC Radio 4, 200 years ago, the Luddite uprisings began in the Midlands and swept through into Yorkshire and Lancashire. For a few short months, the country teetered on the edge of rebellion. In The Luddite Lament, the award-winning singer and writer John Tams looks at the story of the Luddites through the prism of the songs they left behind.
He may censure great Lud's disrespect for the laws, who ne'er for a moment reflects that foul imposition alone was the cause which produced these unhappy effects.
Thorpe, William, 23, hanged.
Brooke, Thomas, 32, hanged.
Dean, Jonathan, 28, hanged.
Mellor, George, 22, hanged.
Milne, Charles, 22, transported.
Walker, John.
I like the songs that hold working class history together. They're closer to the people and the reality of what the working life was like, and the struggles and the turmoil and the battles that were fought by working class men and women. That's what attracted me to this programme.
OK, it's a box, part of our Treasury Solicitor collection. So we're looking on the legal side of things and state prosecutions. Right, so essentially then we've got the two bundles that relate to the Luddites. My name's Paul Carter. I work at the National Archives at Kew, and I'm the Principal Record Specialist for Modern Domestic Records. We refer to people who don't want to use the latest applications, who don't want to have a mobile phone, who don't want to, you know, use the new technologies, if you like. And we say, oh, so they're a Luddite. And that's not what a Luddite was. The people who lived through this period, and I'll say to you now, it's a fascinating period to study, but an awful one to live through. I come from the West Riding. It's a lovely place. Love to get back up when I can. And I enjoy reading about and trying to understand what life would have been like there at that time. But there's no way ever that I would want to have lived there in the first couple of decades of the 19th century.
We've come today to the Tolson Museum in Huddersfield. And we're going to meet Dr. John Hargreaves, a local historian.
Bread prices in 1812 reached the highest level of any year in the 19th century or any previous year in the 18th century. This was a year in which Britain was engaged in a protracted war with revolutionary and Napoleonic France. And the war involved Napoleon's economic blockade and normal commercial relationships were severely disrupted. And so there was a lot of pressure on manufacturers to consider ways of cutting their costs.
Machine breaking had been going on well before 1811, but it was in the spring of that year that it reached new levels. The word Luddism was first used in a newspaper report a few months later. Letters and songs appeared, signed by, or paying tribute to, General Ludd.
The guilt he may fear, but no vengeance he aims at the honest man's life or estate. His wrath is entirely confined to white frames and to those that old prices abate.
My name's Roy Palmer, and for many years I've been preoccupied with traditional music and street balladry. The song really sets out the Luddite case. They are looking to defend their standards of workmanship and, of course, to defend their jobs. Innovation and so forth, one has to accept, but too often when innovation comes, the conclusion is, well, sorry, you lot, too bad, we've got a better way of doing it, so goodbye, yeah. Fend for yourselves. Mm.
To some degree, you'd got people pushed right to the edge. The new economy, the kind of unregulated industrial capitalism of that very early period, had no protections built in for the ordinary working person. There had been, and there had been legislation. There'd been legislation around the introduction of gig mills. There'd been legislation about the number of looms that a master should control. There'd been legislation about apprenticeships and the control of numbers going into the trade. And all of those were in place, and the Luddites knew about them, and they appealed to Parliament in regard to them, but all to no avail. So it wasn't that they hadn't tried these constitutional petitioning very peaceful ways. It was that they had no purchase. Machines per se is not the issue.
Was there someone called Ned Ludd?
Yes and no. It is possible that Ned Ludd existed, and there are stories dating from the 1760s and 70s of a lad called Ned Ludd or Ned Ludlam. He was apprenticed to a stockinger, in other words, a framework knitter, and he was thrashed by this man for allegedly being idle, or alternatively, he was regarded as stupid, and he flew into rages and smashed up machinery. And so when Luddite activity, as we now know it, started, the word Luddite was coined, and this was 1811. There's no record of that word before 1811.
Is it a coincidence that it rhymes with Robin Hood?
It is possible that the song General Ludd's Triumph specifically says, we've had enough of Robin Hood, now we want General Ludd.
Yeah. And does it go, chant no more your bold rhymes about bold Robin Hood, his feet I would little admire. I will sing you the praises of General Ludd, the hero of Nottinghamshire.
That's very much it.
Well, I'm having a drink at the Shears Inn. It's a very celebrated Yorkshire pub, 8 miles south of Bradford. Iconic in many ways in terms of working class history, because this is where the Luddites met, in a little room upstairs above my head where I'm sat here at this bar. Nearly 200 years ago, another man sat here, had a drink and sang a song. His name was John Walker and the song was called The Cropper Lads. I'll give it a go.
Come, cropper lads of high renown, who like to drink strong ale that's brown.
What is a cropper?
A cropper was involved in the finishing process of the manufacture of woolen cloth.
The cropper lads are we, and gallant lads we be. With lusty stroke, the sheer frames broke. The cropper lads are we.
The cropper song finishes with the verse about Great Enoch still shall lead the van. And Great Enoch was a big hammer with which they were on their way to smash up the shear frames.
Great Enoch still shall lead the van. Stop him who dare, stop him who can.
Must be 10 or 12 pounds in weight.
I would say at least that, yes.
Yeah, if you swing that, it's going to make a hell of a mess, isn't it?
Yes, it was made at the foundry of Enoch and James Taylor in Marsden. Enoch was a very interesting figure. He not only manufactured the hammers that were used to destroy the machines, but he also manufactured the machines themselves. And so the
shrewd, war... Shrewd businessman.
Shrewd businessman. So the war cry was, Enoch hath made them, Enoch shall break them.
As you can hear, we're at the confluence of some major roads now. This is Dumb Steeple, D-U-M-B, Steeple. It's a stone-built monolith, a kind of needle, which has shifted from where it was when, at the dead of night, many, many men, Luddites, gathered here to move forward to make their attack on Rawfall's Mill. And with Dr. John Hargreaves, how many men would there have been here that night, John?
We're not sure of the exact numbers. They'd hoped to have, I think, about 150 leaving from this spot. There were certainly over 100. And they would have gathered, perhaps some of them early in the evening at the Shears Inn at Liversedge, and then have moved down here for a midnight rendezvous. This was April 11th, 1812, and it was to launch what would have been their largest planned attack to date, an attack on William Cartwright's Rawfall's Mill.
We're en route from their meeting place at Dumb Steeple and the journey they made in April 1812. Why particularly did they choose that mill?
William Cartwright, who owned the mill,
was one of the manufacturers who was absolutely determined to be undeterred by the Luddites in employing the new machinery. Cartwright had fortified, really, the mill like a medieval fortress. He had lifted paving stones at the higher levels to form barricades. He'd carboys of vitriol, sulfuric acid, that were ready to upturn should people actually gain access to the
And did they employ levels. Those and did they use those on them?
No, he didn't use those. They didn't actually affect an entry into the mill. He'd got arrangement with the military that if the bell in the belfry of the mill were tolled, cavalry might arrive on the scene.
One of the things that gets me, and I just think this is one of the really sort of really iconic moments in British social history, are the events relating to John Booth and Samuel Hartley, who were two of the Luddites. They die on the attack on Rolfer's Mill, and they're both shot. They're both alive at the time that the bell in the mill is ringing, and they know that the troops are going to be here soon. And what that means is that everybody that's there has got to get back to their own homes and their own villages and get into their own bed. Because, of course, the constables are going to be now checking to see if the bell's going off, who's not where they should be. George Mellor, who's one of the key figures in Yorkshire Luddism, realises that they're not going to be able to take the mill. And the reports indicate that he sits down next to the two men, Booth and Hartley, and says, look, you know, we've got to go. But, you know, you remember the oaths we took, you know, not to say. So the two men are left. They're taken away. The two men are taken away to Robertstown, and they're taken to the Star Inn. And I think one of the men who's there is a Reverend Hammond Robertson, who's a Tory, very much an anti-Luddite. The Reverend Hammond Robertson says, you know, you need to make your peace with God. You know, we don't think we're going to have to help you through this. For your soul's sake, do you want to tell me a little bit more about it and who was organising it and who was there? And the men refused to tell. Because another feature of Luddism, that inability for the authorities to find out what's going on and who's involved. One of the men, the youngest, was John Booth. He was only 19 at the time. While he's on the bed dying, and the Reverend Hammond Robertson is saying, oh, you must, for the sake of your souls, tell his information. Just before he dies, he calls over and says, come here, come here. Of course, the Reverend rubs his hands and goes over and says, what is it, what is it? And the young man says, can you keep a secret? Yes, yes, of course I can, my son, of course I can. So can I. And he dies, this young boy of 19, refusing to give any information on his comrades who'd taken part in the raid.
I, of my own free will and accord, do hereby promise and swear that I will never reveal any of the names of any one of this secret committee under the penalty of being sent out of this world by the first brother that may meet me.
The oaths were administered primarily in the northern counties, Lancashire and Yorkshire. Not many were administered in the Midlands.
Professor Kevin Binfield is from Murray State University in Kentucky. He's the editor of The Writings of the Luddites.
The oath typically involves swearing allegiance to the Luddite cause on pain of death for violating that allegiance. The Luddites in the Midlands were not infiltrated at all. I think that the reason is that Midlands Luddism comes out of the framework knitting trade. Framework knitting was a long-established trade with a system of apprenticeship. Many of the apprentices would have known each other for a long time, so it would have been very difficult for a newcomer to infiltrate as a framework knitter. In Yorkshire, the situation was similar. The Yorkshire Luddites were primarily croppers, who also had a system of apprenticeship and a long-established mutual familiarity that would have precluded infiltration. However, there are instances in West Yorkshire of members of other trades joining in on Luddite attacks, the most famous being John Booth, a saddlemaker's apprentice who joined in the attack on Rawfold's Mill.
Our knowledge of Luddite songs in Yorkshire was utterly transformed by a local historian called Frank Peel. In the 1870s, he was working on a book called The Risings of the Luddites. These were the songs that had gone underground. And Peel was told, for example, about a man called John Hurst. He was involved in the attack on a mill, Rawfold's Mill. for decades, he clammed up and tied, didn't say a word about his Luddite past. But then when he was a grandfather, he was heard singing his grandchildren to sleep with things like, "Come all you croppers, stout and bold, let your faith grow stronger still. Those cropping lads of the county of York, they broke the shears at Horse Falls Mill." The name was changed to various different mills in different versions, you know.
Depending where they were operating.
Yeah.
Now, we're on our way to the cloth hall.
Yes, or the remains of the cloth hall. The cloth hall used to stand in the centre of Huddersfield on Cloth Hall Street, and in 1930 it was demolished. But they had the foresight to preserve one of the key features, the entrance to it, and we're looking at that now. If we just walk around so we can see the entrance itself. This was where William Horsfall, the Marsden manufacturer, had been prior to his fatal journey home on April 28th, 1812. About 6:30 in the evening, he came under fire from Luddites. Horsfall, who'd been one of the leading opponents of the Luddites.
Was this a murder of Horsfall or an assassination, John?
This was termed by contemporaries as an assassination. Some of the press reports referred to them as assassins.
17 days after the attack on Raw Falls, Horsfall was shot. And less than a fortnight later, though unrelated, the Prime Minister was assassinated. There were tens of thousands of troops in Yorkshire and Lancashire. It must have felt like a place under siege.
The Home Office 42 series is where the material rests that were sent into the Home Office. OK. This is a Luddite verse. It's a paper that was posted up in Nottingham on the morning of the 9th of May in 1812. And it makes reference here to Percival, who's the Prime Minister. He holds the distinction of being the only Prime Minister who was assassinated. This is, "Welcome, Ned Ludd, your case is good. Make Percival your aim. For by this bill, 'tis understood, 'tis death to break the frame." What we're referring to here is the government's response of bringing in the capital offence for frame breaking. And I think this is perhaps one of the areas where songs and poems really bring to life, if you like, the history of the kind of individuals who aren't going to leave written accounts. I mean, obviously, you know, frame breaking, it's capital offence. No one's going to leave an account of what I did during the Luddite disturbances.
There's an instance of another Luddite song which has been preserved thanks to its being given in evidence in a case. It was to do with a man who'd been arrested for stealing lead from a roof. And he wasn't just flogging it as people do nowadays. The idea was to use it to cast into bullets for the Luddites to use. And as a piece of additional evidence to make it clear they'd got the goods on him, they proved he was a Luddite because he had written down a Luddite song at the request of a person who was a police constable acting as a spy. It's the one that begins, "You heroes of England who wish to have a trade, be true to each other and be not afraid."
You heroes of England who wish for a trade, be true to each other and be not afraid. Though the bayonet is fixed, they can do no good if we keep to the rules of General Lord.
It's interesting because the bayonet's fixed, and it's another reference to the army. And it's said, and I think it's true, that there were more soldiers engaged in holding down the Luddites than there were at that time in the peninsula with Wellington.
On its own, it wouldn't be enough to secure a conviction, to say that somebody sang a certain thing in a certain pub, there would have to then be some more substantive. But what it would be part of the evidence to show the kind of person that I was.
You mentioned the assassination of Percival. This is mentioned in one of the very few printed street ballads that I've seen, which even mentions the Luddites. And it's called Hunting a Loaf. The prince has left his name off out of prudence. But somebody knew who'd printed it. G. Coates, printer, Alfreton.
Where I was born. It's in Derbyshire, right. Just in Derbyshire.
That's where I was born.
The loaf that they're hunting is a big loaf you could buy at a shilling, and he can't find it because prices have gone up. So that's why it's called Hunting a Loaf. It begins, "Good people, I pray, give ear unto what I say, and pray do not call it sedition. For these great men of late, they have cracked my pate. I'm wounded in a woeful condition." But he's mentioning sedition. He's saying, don't accuse me of sedition, because the criminalisation of the Luddites, the capital punishment for the Luddites has already come in by the time this appears.
I wanted to sing the song Hunting the Loaf in the place it was written, or at least printed, so I've come to Alfreton, a former mining community on the edge of the Erewash Valley. I mean, Alfreton House, one of the oldest buildings in the town, dates back to 1650, so would definitely have been around, obviously, at the time of the Luddites. "But in Derby, it's true, aye, and Nottingham too, poor men to the jail they've been taking. They say that Ned Ludd, as I understood, 1,000 white frames has been breaking. Now, is it not bad? There's no work to be had, the poor to be starved in their station. And if they do steal, they're straightway sent to jail, and they're hanged by the laws of the nation."
We might be surprised that we've come up with something. It might be only a chorus or something.
The interesting thing is, whilst we're dealing with Luddites particularly, yeah, that you see relationships with struggle songs generally, don't you?
I do, yeah, but I mean...
Whether they're recent or not.
Yes, that's true. I do see that. I see that process of struggle for a better life.
I spoke to Roy Bailey, who was in the vanguard of the folk revival. Got an example?
Well, there's a song which is, for me, about Luddism, although it's not from the Midlands. It's, in fact, from Hampshire. And I'll just sing you one verse. It's a song called The Owlsbury Lads. Owl, spelt as in the bird, Owlsbury Lads. It goes something like this. "The 30th of November, 1830, the Owlsbury Lads, they did prepare all for the machinery. And when they did get there, my eye, how they let fly. The machinery flew to pieces in the twinkling of an eye. The mob, such a mob, you never did see before. And if you live 100 years, you never will no more." Now, that's a Luddite song, isn't it? Would call a Luddite song.
Can I take you back to the first time you came across the word Luddite?
How I was taught it, I suppose. That's the first time I came across it. I was a schoolboy and we dealt with Luddism. That was dealt with. This was to do with people who were against progress. That's what my teacher said. So I thought, oh, against progress. I mean, not. I don't like them. And as I got older, I began to realise, really just watching what was happening in other industries and in other processes, that it wasn't a question of them being opposed to the introduction of machinery. It was the wholesale introduction without regard to the communities that were being destroyed. In other words, what it was needed was a managed introduction of the machinery. The powerful want it now. Oh, there's money to be made. We can do it now. This way to do it. You get up at 5:30 or I dock your wages for the day. God, you know, up every morning at 5 is a line of a song, Poverty Knock, I think. Was it poverty, poverty, knock? Loom it is saying all day, poverty, poverty, knock.
Gaffer?
Gaffer's too skinny to pay. Poverty, poverty, knock. Honest one eye on the clock. I know I can guttle when I hear me shuttle go. Poverty, poverty, knock. No more chant your old rhymes about Bold Robin Hood. His feats I do little admire.
My name's Boff Worley, and I'm a part of the band Chumbawamba.
Now the hero of Nottinghamshire.
What actually interests you in Luddite songs, and how did that interest develop?
Well, you know, we'd made a... This is in the sort of early 1980s. We'd made a couple of very sort of loud, shouty albums of modern protest music, and we started looking back at where this stuff was coming from and whether it had to be blokes shouting very loudly and playing guitar loudly. And we started listening to people playing acoustic guitars, and then following that back, it was a lot easier finding the sung history of rural England, and let's all sing about, you know, the jolly month of May and you know, a ploughing we will go. There's thousands and thousands of that sort of thing.
His wrath is entirely confined to white frames and to those that all prices abate.
There may be only a handful of songs still remaining about Luddism, but they show a picture of social change, of working class lives.
Lud, who can all opposition defy, was the grand executioner made.
Luddism, at its height, lasted for under 2 years. In 1813, a special commission sat in York. 64 men had been arrested. 6 were transported. 17 were executed. Luddism, to all intents and purposes, was over.
We almost felt it was our duty to our audience to say, look, you know, there's this fantastic body of work back there, that this is great people's history, it's community history, and it's radical history, and it's people singing it. So here we go, let's sing some of these songs.
Whether guarded by soldiers along the highway,
Brooke, Thomas,
or closely
32,
secured
Thorpe,
in a room.
William, 23,
he shivers
Hang,
them up
Walker,
by night
John,
and by day,
31,
and
Hang,
nothing can
Mellor,
soften
George,
their doom.
22, Hang.
Oh, General Lud, with fire and hammer and blood, with Enoch he stood for the general good. Oh, General Lud.
The Luddite Lament was presented by John Tams. The programme was produced in Manchester by Nicholas Swords. The songs were sung on location by Roy Palmer, Boff Worley, Roy Bailey and John Tams.